G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on Truth to You. That's truth2u.org, where you can also sign up for the weekly newsletter and keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me, of course, is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
G'day, you too.
Nice to have you back, my friend. I was just reading one of the comments from last week from Janice, who said, another great episode. Thank you so much for bringing the information to the people. That was chapter 18 of Judges.
Thank you, Janice.
Thank you, Janice.
Always nice to hear good things from people.
Yeah, indeed it is. Indeed it is. So, 18. Now, hang on a second. We did do 19, right? Oh, of course we did, because we're pre-recording.
Yes, we did. Yes, we.
That was on chapter 18.
We're pre-recording everything because, for example, next week is going to be... Now everyone's going to know when we do this. So next week is going to be Yom Teruah, and there's also the Rabbinic Rosh Hashanah before that. We're not too sure exactly when everything is going to be. By the time this recording is released, we'll actually know. But we're pre-recording everything because next week there's going to be no time for anything.
And that reminds me, by the way, because just to let everybody know, those who are subscribers to the newsletter, the Truth to You newsletter, if you're not already, you can get onto the website, truth2u.org, truth2u.org, subscribe to the newsletter, and you will get a podcast from the past, and they will be, over the next few weeks, of course, the one that you did, Yoel, on Yom Teruah, the one on Yom Kippur, and of course, Sukkot. They will be coming Sukkot up in the next few weeks.
Sukkot was an interesting one because I said a few things that the sparked like 90-something comments on that one.
Yeah, that's true. It did. It went on and on and on, didn't it? There was a whole lot of rabbit trails in the comments if people are interested in reading those. And adding to that, by all means, please get into the comments. But I'm going to be letting those ones out of the bag once again because they were great. They were really good discussions, and we appreciate those. So they will be in the podcast from the past. But today, Yoel... Today we're doing chapter 20. We're up to chapter 20, Judges chapter 20. Oh my goodness, it kind of continues on from the debacle of last week, which was, of course, the Levite and his concubine and the terrible things that happened to her. And I don't want to go into... Well, you know what? Well, we don't have to go into detail because there's kind of a summary in the first part of chapter 20. Shall I read it?
By all means.
All right, I'm going to read it through because it kind of, you know, it gives us... gives it to us in a nutshell. In verse 1, it says, so all the children of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, and as well as from the land of Gilead, and the congregation gathered...
Gilead.
What did I say? Gilead. Let me read it again. From Dan to Beersheba, as well as from the land of Gilead. Okay.
Very good.
Thank you. And the congregation gathered together as one man before Yehovah at Mitzpah. Now, before I continue on into verse 2, I notice there's an emphasis on that. They gathered as one man before Yehovah. There's an emphasis there. I think it mentions it, just to let the listeners know, it mentions that about at least three times, I think, in this chapter.
So it's actually very interesting. It says, Ve'yitzeu kol b'nei Yisrael. All the people of Israel, all the children of Israel went. They actually exited where they leave, and and it's interesting if you take for example kitetze, it uses a very similar language. Vayetzeu kind of indicates the issue they're going out to war, because we have, for example, kitetze milchama lo evecha. We have that from 2 weeks ago, the parasha of kitetze, and it talks about war. So vayetzeu here is an indication of war. Kol b'nei Israel, kol being the entire congregation of the children of Israel. And it's very interesting, also it uses Tikahel Ha'ida, and we have the issue of the Kahal, which also takes us back again to Kitetze, about the certain types of people which are not allowed to come in the Kahal, and there's different opinions what this Kahal means. Some people say it's marriage, some people say it's in the assemblies of the nation, they're not really part of the nation, they can't come in the assemblies, which kind of can shed light on certain types of groups that, for example, they say these people, the Ammonites and the Moabites, can't join, even 10th generation can't join in because they're sworn enemies of Israel, for example. So maybe this kind of interprets why they can't join the Kahal. The Kahal is a congregation. They can be spies inside it, any decisions that you made, stuff like that. And it uses the word Tikahel Ha'eda. And Eda, this is the first time we see the word Eda, as far as I remember, since the Torah, we don't really see the word Eda.
Really?
And then it says, Ke'ish Echad, as one man, and this is again something that indicates the issue of becoming like one man, one opinion, one movement, everyone together. Mm. And then it says, Midan ad Be'er Sheva, from the northest place that people are at to the northern city of Israel, the most southern city of Israel. So if you remember, mm-hmm. Be'er Sheva was the southern border, and the land of Gilad, not only inside the promised land, also from the other side of the river.
Mm-hmm.
And they all gather together to Mitzpah. It's using like certain languages from one end to the other, from all corners of the land, and they're all gathering to this place called Mitzpah.
And they all gathered as one man. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And the leaders of all the people and all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. Yoel, 400,000, that's an enormous amount of people.
It's a pretty big army, but you have to remember that the Israelites never had an imperialistic mindset. And we're still dealing with a period where there was even not even a monarchy in view. So when you have an army, it's like the army today here in Israel. It's the army of the people. Anyone from a certain age gets recruited to the Israeli army.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same thing. This is not an army where there's a king and he has his soldiers and he's professionally trained soldiers. These are just people, and you know, grab your pitchfork and come. That's basically it. So this is why we have such a large number.
And so here they are. Now, the children of Benjamin heard that the children of Israel had gone up to Mitzpah. Then the children of Israel said, tell us, they're talking to the Levite, right? How did this wicked deed happen? And so here we have the recount in a nutshell of what happens to the Levite. The husband of the woman I've got here who was murdered answered and said...
Husband works. It says, Ish ha'isha ha'nirtzacha. So Ish usually means, it doesn't use the word Baal here. Mm-hmm. It uses the word ish, which can mean man, but in this case, it actually means husband.
Mm, okay, he said, my concubine and I went to Givah.
Givah. So he uses, it says, in Hebrew, it says Givata. Givata means to Givah.
Okay. So, but the name of the place is Givah.
Givah, which, by the way, the word Givah in Hebrew just means a hill.
No, okay. I thought, is that different to a tell or...
So a tell is an unnatural hill that builds up throughout centuries with cities being destroyed upon that certain area until it turns into, looks like a hill.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I went to Lachish, for example, mm-hmm. it sticks out like a sore thumb. It just, it's there.
Right.
A hill is just a hill. It's a natural hill. It's a natural form of the formation of the mountain. So it's actually called, it's called Givah or Geva bin Yamin as well. There's other places which are referred as Geva bin Yamin, which Givah and Geva are the same thing. It's just a construct state. The Geva is just Givah of bin Yamin.
And so he says that they went there to obviously what was a hill and named after such, which belonged to Benjamin, to spend the night. And the men of Givah rose against me, and they surrounded the house at night because of me, and they intended to kill me, but instead they ravished my concubine so that she died. So I took hold of my concubine.
So wait, he says something. He says in the beginning of the verse, because in English it's reversed a bit. In Hebrew it says, Ve'kumu alai ba'alei ha-givah. And ba'alei ha-givah means the masters of Givah. So he's actually saying the people who attacked us were not just hooligans. They're saying these were the masters of Givah. These were the important people of Givah. And it's interesting because in contrast to what we read last time, it just mentions, a few bullies showed up. He is saying, no, these were the masters of Givah. So it could be that he's telling us who it really was, or he's lying, saying, he wants to bring, destruction on them.
Yeah.
So he's lying and saying.
You've got to admit, it's a little bit revised. I mean, he's missing out on certain details. There's no doubt.
Yeah,
about it.
He's a wonderful man. I came there with my concubine. He doesn't say that. He never mentions here that he throws her out.
That he throws her out to him. No.
He doesn't mention anything. And I think he's blaming the masters of Givah because he's trying to, bring destruction in the entire place. Because he says the master, the leaders of this place are corrupt, so it must be everyone's corrupt as well.
Mm.
Could be. And so he's enticing war.
He is. And I mean, look, we've got 400,000 soldiers. But he goes on to say, they ravaged my concubine so that she died. I took hold of my concubine, cut her in pieces, and sent her throughout the territories of the inheritance of Israel because they committed lewdness and outrage in Israel.
So the other thing is he also mentions here, he says here, they got up, ve'akumu, usually kum means to rise up, to get up. But sometimes the Bible uses certain verbs to say the issue of to encourage oneself or to encourage someone to do something. And he said they got up basically to act, to do something. Mm. It was the owners of Ivan. They surround the house up. You know, surround the house is true. You know, every lie has a bit of truth in it. And he says it during the night. And he says they wanted to kill me. They had in their imagination, they wanted, because he uses the word dimu from the word dome or deme, which means to resemble something, which means in their minds they wanted to kill me. And my concubine they raped. Mm. Now this is also not a lie, but we're now seeing the fact that
selected information.
It's a certain degree of selective information, but he's also basically saying, you know, it was more than just raping her. They wanted to kill me. Now, what do we know about the original story? They just wanted to rape him. If we assume it was rape, you know, we talk about the fact that I can argue it's not rape, and we don't have information that they actually wanted to kill him.
No, well, what they said was bring him out so that we may know him, and it's not like they wanted to introduce each other to, you know. I mean, they wanted to know him, you know. And,
We assume it's to know in the biblical sense, as people
assume so. And he says, and all of you are children of Israel, give your advice and counsel here and now, he's demanding.
Yeah. Now,
before we go on, Yoel, before we go on, I have to tell the listeners, I thought that there was some, if they can hear that in the background, I thought there was a corroboree going on, like there was some sort of didgeridoo party going on in Yoel's... apartment,
I can pull out one of the didgeridoos and play, but you know it's not gonna. When I play, I can't talk, so there's no point. No, I live in a house that's still being constructed. We moved in, and my landlord, sweet guy, decided that he's going to put all the effort to make sure the apartment we're in is ready to move into. So he postponed everything in his house. So now they're finalizing everything. They're installing the marble, for example, in the kitchen.
Nice.
So I'm very happy.
But the reason why I wanted to stop is because what we're listening to in the background is the building of within a settlement in Judea. And I wanted to point that out because really I think that's really cool to have in the background. We can actually hear the construction and building of something in Judea. I just find that really cool. I just want to point that out.
So when I build my own house, I'll take the computer and have the noise of the construction around us.
Sure.
We have that. God willing, hopefully in the next couple of years, I'll be able to build my own house. I don't want to buy it.
And may there be more. May there be more permanent structures in Judea and in Samaria that Jewish settlements and so on and so forth. We'll talk about that. We'll do a program on that one day soon. All right.
Yeah, I can actually attribute several structures to my own two hands in Samaria. There were a few structures that I was involved in building there. So yeah, it's an interesting subject. It's an interesting thing. I have several very interesting stories from Samaria and Judea. So yeah, we can do a program about that sometime.
Do that sometime. Verse 8. So all the people arose as one man. That's the second time it says it, saying, "None of us will go out of his tents, nor will any turn back to his house. But now this is the thing which we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. We will take..." Now, oh man, do I have some questions for you about this, Yoel. He says, "We will take 10 men out of every 100 throughout all the tribes of generation, 100 out of every 1,000, 1,000 out of every 10,000. So basically say we'll take 10% of the men to make provisions for the people that when they come to Gibeah in Benjamin, they may repay all the vileness that they have done in Israel." So all the men of Israel gathered against the city, united together as one man. There's the third time it says it.
Actually, it says the word chavirim, which means friends, which means united, chever, a unity of something. Like, for example, we had chever hakeni. Remember, that was the binding of keni. It was a certain group that turned... named themselves Keni. So here they're one man, chavirim, like chavurim, together, is binded together. So it's very interesting because this word is considered very, very rare. It's put it like that.
So it's highly significant that all of Israel except for Benjamin have come together as one man. Okay. "Then the tribes of Israel sent men through all the tribes of Benjamin saying, what is this wickedness that has occurred among you? Now therefore deliver up the men, the perverted men." Now we talked about that. That's again, that's the men of Belial. Is that right? Belial?
Belial, yeah. Bene Belial.
which potentially may mean men without yoke, men without the yoke of Torah. We did talk about that last week, but it appears there again in verse 13, so that we may put them to death and remove the evil from Israel. But the children of Benjamin would not listen to their voice of their brethren. Boy, they could have solved a whole lot of problems then and there, but they didn't go for it.
They could have. By the way, it says here, "Venevarah Am Israel," and "Nevarah" from the root of "baar." To it's not just to, you know, get rid of or something. It's actually from the word "baar," which is to burn. And it's interesting. The Bible, the Torah, uses the same term sometimes. Basically, to destroy something, it burns. It gets consumed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not as if they're going to burn someone here. It's just an issue. It's very interesting that they understood fire being the burning of something is the complete eradication of a place. And this is why you have cities being burnt and sure. stuff like that, because that's how you completely uproot something.
So instead, the children of Israel, the children of Benjamin, gathered together from their cities to Gibeah to go to battle against the children of Israel. This blows my mind, Yoel, because there's 400,000 soldiers saying, "Listen, you just give us the guys that did this. We'll end them, and we'll all go home, and it's all right. Don't worry about it." But they've gone, "You know what? No, let's go into the city and we'll fight them." That's what they decided to do.
So Benjamin basically said they don't want to listen to them. They basically go, no, 1,000 times, no, we're not interested in giving you anyone from our tribe, which gives a certain level of insight to the issue of the unity of Israel, at least at the time, where they understood that they all come from the same family, they all come from mm-hmm. the same group, they're all blood-related and everything, but mm-hmm. there's an agreement that they live side by side, but they're not really one people.
Mm-hmm.
This is why an entire tribe can, you know, basically say no to the rest of the tribes. So it was it's an interesting thing. This is probably one of the issues of criticism that comes here when they say there's no king in Israel. The realization if there's no king, there's nothing binding everyone together.
Mm-hmm. True.
And it's an interesting thing how to look at this. Some researchers say they had an unwritten, unspoken agreement that they're living side by side, but they don't owe anyone anything. If I decide to do something, it's only because we have mutual relationships. It kind of reminds me of the story with the Athenians and the Spartans when the Persians attacked them, where the Greeks sent a letter, the Athenians sent a letter to the Spartans saying, "Because of intellectual and historical background that we share with one another, we agree to help you."
Mm.
You know, you're actually one nation. No, it's because of historical things and because we're kind of related to one another and we have a mutual thing. It's kind of the same idea what's going on here. Again, the reason they were able to unite under something, and this is why I emphasize that they went to Mitzpah to meet up with God, you know, in front of God, is because really what united them as a nation was the fact that there's one God, there's one mm-hmm. supreme power above everyone, and they recognize an evil deed done. And I think what happens here as well is Benjamin basically goes and says, "What are you talking about? Maybe the people in Benjamin knew a bit more information about what was going on, and this is why they refused." But the writer doesn't say anything of this. The emphasis the writers of the story were trying to point out was, look at the mess we were in when there was no king.
Mm. And again, that's the disclaimer that appears in... does it appear at the end of this? No, it appears... It appears again at the end of chapter 21.
Yeah, at the end of the book.
It's just like saying, now remember, I know this is messy, but remember, we had no king, you know, okay? Come on, so... But this was
cut us some slack. It's no one's fault. There was no kids.
Verse 15. And from their cities at that time, the children of Benjamin numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who numbered 700 select men.
Such a mess with the numbers. Wow. There's such a mess with the numbers.
So there is some confusion.
It says 26,000 here, and then later on it mentions 25,000. So one of the explanations I heard to this one was, one of the explanations I was told was that it was really 25,700. But the Bible has a tendency to round numbers up to give you a whole number. But when there's a need to be specific, it becomes very, very specific. So it was really 25,700.
Yeah, because there is a discrepancy later on where mm-hmm. it suggests, by the time you get to verse 35, and we'll be there, that 900 were left, and yet it goes on to say that 600 were left. So there's obviously a discrepancy of 300 men. And so when it says 26,000, potentially it's rounding up. To be more specific, it could be 25,700.
So there's actually several rules regarding numbers in the Bible. So, for example, if we take the Book of Numbers, where there's at least twice when they count people, when we normally, when we count, we say 126, for example. And the Bible, for some reason, goes 620, 100. What does it do with that reversal? And the explanation I learned about this was that when we're counting something important, we start from the lower numbers because we want to be exact. So when there's a need to be exact, it starts from the lower numbers because those numbers get lost easily. But when we're kind of approximating or we're trying to give, you know, a more or less number, then there's no, then first of all, we try to say something, you know, not 100% exact. Then first of all, there's an issue where it gives you a number from the high to the low. And sometimes the Bible rounds up numbers because it's approximately 26,000 people. But when we actually get to the, when we start cutting them down and looking what's going on, we'll mention the correct number. That's one of the explanations I've seen. Here, again, it's very evident. It's quite clear that the numbers have been rounded up because later on we see something a bit more exact. But we do have to remember something very important. I think I mentioned this when we started these chapters, specifically from chapter 18. Even before that, even from chapter 17, I mentioned there's actually an overall understanding by when you read the language in Hebrew, there's a lot of muffled, confused language here, which indicates this is probably a very, very early story. And when the editors tried to put compile the Book of Judges, you know, they basically had probably a few confused variations in front of them, you know, and they just tried to write this down. All that there was already a book, and then someone tried to copy it and made a mistake. And there's different ways of approaching it, but the overall opinion I've seen, because you do notice there's a little of confusion here when you read it in Hebrew, that probably when this was added to the book, the stories were kind of confused, so they just wrote whatever they knew, hoping that they get it right. And by the way, this raises a question, because I know there are a lot of people out there that believe that every word in the Bible was divinely inspired, and you know, someone's probably going to hate me for this, but when it comes to historical writings, I'm not convinced.
It doesn't necessarily have to be that. No, it doesn't have to. But this is a perfect example, Yoel, obviously, because I mean, we've offered a possible solution to the problem, but the fact remains that the math does not add up in this chapter, as we're going to see.
Exactly. So if it's divinely inspired and there's something wrong, it can be one of two answers. You can go to the traditional answer and say, well, there's a secret here. There's something secretive here. And I don't like answers like that. I spent several years studying Kabbalah. Trust me, there are no secrets here. But the one thing that we can say, and I think we have to admit to this, is that mistakes were made throughout the centuries, and there are probably mistakes in the biblical text. When it comes to the Torah, the level of precision when it came to the Torah was so high. And it was like, you know, there's a saying, for example, I learned to become a scribe. So I learned a lot of these rules and everything. And it's like they try to make it impossible to make a mistake. Seriously. I mean, we're talking about you write an entire scroll.
When we were talking about chapter 18, remember we talked about verse 4 where the phrase thus and so, you know, and they said to him, thus and so Micah did for me, yada, yada, yada. And so you wouldn't find that in the Torah. Where in the Torah does it say thus and so? I mean, it's specific and it's repetitive. But here in Judges, it's a little bit more relaxed, right?
Yeah, and also the Torah, if you remember, the Torah was given to the Levites and the priests, my gang, and, we're trying to be as precise as possible, and there was a scribal tradition and everything. On the other hand, the rest of the books were written, we don't even know who wrote them. We just know they exist. We just have them. And it could be that several people wrote the story down in different variations, and then they compiled the people, King Hezekiah compiled the books. There's another thing that we have to think about, and I just want people to ponder about this, is the fact that canonization of books was probably not something very strong amongst the Israelites. There's actually a claim that the whole idea of having a canonized Bible was something which arrived later on through the Persians, because the Persians, for example, were probably some of the first people to actually have canonized forms of books called the Venda Vesta. They were the first nation to have a canonized book, a very precise, specific, passed down in a very specific way kind of thing. While the Torah, yes, the Torah is the first canonized book in the people amongst the people of Israel, because the understanding was it was given, you know, the understanding is that it was God dictated to Moses. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the books, the, you know, a lot of them, if you remember, the nation of Israel went through destruction, so these scrolls somehow survived. And it could be that part of the work which was done during the time of the Second Temple period was to create a Bible, to create something that we can deal with, something that, you know, defines us as a people.
Mm.
And it's very interesting that some books, for example, it mentions the books of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel, we have almost nothing of that. We don't even know what the northern tribes, at least the ones who believed in the God of Israel, what they actually had as books.
Mm.
They might have, if they would have survived, we might have had a Bible 3-4 times thicker. You never know.
Perhaps. That's a really good point. Now, there is a conversation worth having at some stage. There's another program that we have to do at some stage. How did we arrive at the canon that we have today? What other books have validity out there? Why aren't they accepted? That sort of stuff. We have to talk about that. But if we do that now, we'll never end. Verse 16. We've talked about this verse before. Among all the people were 700 select men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss. Now, there's some precision.
Oh, but by the way, before someone tries to do that to me as well, I'm not saying that I don't believe that that the information in the Bible is divinely inspired. Just to clarify that. Mm. We just have to be aware of the fact that there were copying errors in different places, and it can happen. Okay, that was my main point. I'm not waiting for someone to try to shoot me for the window or something.
But we encourage the listeners to do the maths of Judges chapter 20. It is really interesting. 17, now besides Benjamin, the men of Israel numbered 400,000 men who drew the sword. All of these were men of war. The children of Israel arose and went to the... Now, I've got the house of God, but that's not what it says. It says Bet El. Is that correct?
So Bet El is the name of a place. It's not the house of God. Bet El is the Bet El that we all know.
Hmm. Interesting. So they went to Bet El to inquire.
I actually went to Bet El with Keith Johnson when we did the Arab recordings, the part I was involved in.
Ah, this is in the Time Will Tell DB that's just come out, right?
Yeah, Time Will Tell. Hopefully it'll be out soon. You know, if anyone wants to support, we published, you know, Keith published a video. I just shared it on Facebook. A lot of effort was put into this program. Keith literally came here by himself, did almost everything by himself. He took the camera with him. You know, and just did everything and filmed. Yeah,
went all over the place. But you specifically were with him in Bet El, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I was the guy who took him to Bet El. It was pretty cool. We also went to the site that's the traditional site of where Jacob slept. But there's this little thing there. We did a video there as well. There's a lot of exciting stuff. Keith did one thing that I couldn't believe he was able to do it. I am so proud of him, and I'm so glad, so proud of being one of his friends. He actually went to the Temple Mount and proclaimed the name.
I know, but that's the only bit I've seen so far.
I'm like, Keith, you know, you should have taken me with you. What are you doing? I want to be there. I want to be one of the witnesses that happened. You know, when was the last time the name of God was vocalized on the Temple Mount?
Yeah, and not just
when was the last time that was done?
You know? That's the only bit I've seen, and so I've been on the edge of my seat ever since then, and I still haven't seen it, so I'm waiting to see it myself. So I'm looking forward to seeing the bit that you guys did at Bet El as well. But so it goes on to say, yeah, well, they went to Bet El to inquire of God. They said, which of us should go up to battle? Now, they're asking, now, this is my question, and I've got real issues with this, Yoel. Maybe you can help me, because I don't understand it. They're asking God, they're saying, who shall we send first? What regiment are we going to send out first? Who's going to go the front line? Who's going first? And God says, send Judah. Judah first. Okay, so they've gone to Bet El, they've inquired of God, and Yehovah has said, Judah first. And we all agree with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the children of Israel rose in the morning and encamped against Gibeah, and the men of Israel went out to battle against Benjamin, and the men of Israel put themselves in battle array to fight against them at Gibeah. Then the children of Benjamin came out of Gibeah, and on that day cut down to the ground 22,000 men of the Israelites.
It's kind of funny. I'm listening to your translation, and the positioning of the words in Hebrew is different.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, that happens. But
cut to the ground.
22,000.
Yeah, so the ground which is the accusative of Vayashchitu, or it's one of the accusatives of Vayashchitu. It's kind of funny how they reworded things in English. I'm just, what?
But this how is of Judah, right? Get... Do we yeah, understand this correctly? It is Judah. 22,000 of Judah dead. Is that what we understand?
Judah is in the lead here. Mm-hmm. Who will be the champions that go down to war first? That's probably the question they were asking. Mm-hmm. And it might have been that many of Judah were killed, but it doesn't certainly mean it was only from Judah.
Okay, because it says that 22,000 men of the Israelites, doesn't say of Judah specifically, so it might have been the front line of Judah plus whoever else came behind. And the people, that is the men of Israel, encouraged themselves and again formed the battle line at the place where they had put themselves in array on the first day. Then, Yoel, again, the children of Israel went and wept before Yehovah until evening.
Such muffled language here. What is he using? It's I'm looking at the language here now that I'm having actually a bit of time to look at this. Wow, this is strange. Some of what's going on here is a bit strange, that's all.
Truly. Well, they say, you know, they ask in counsel of Yehovah again, you know, as they did the first time, as they should, you would expect. And they say, shall I again draw near for battle against the children of my brother Benjamin? So is it now they're referring to him as my brother Benjamin? Are they having second thoughts? Like maybe this wasn't a good idea. Were we not meant to do this?
The feeling is that this is what's going on. You know, they cry until the evening. You know, it's a long weeping thing. It's a mourning thing. So they didn't really want this to turn out. What they really were expecting is that they'll see the big army, they'll surrender, or you know, a few people will be killed, and that's it. 22,000.
22,000.
They're standing there, banging their heads on things, going like,
How did that happen?
It doesn't make sense. There's 400,000 people against 26,000.
Yeah,
that's like almost 20 times more.
Yeah,
and 22,000 people were killed.
After, mind you, after they inquired of God and said, "Who shall go first?" Oh, and we're to understand that Yehovah said, "Judah will go first." And even though it's not as if he's, I mean, it's kind of weird because here, the second time they inquire of Yehovah, he says, go up against him. Once again, do it for sure.
But he doesn't tell them they'll win.
This is the thing.
And the writer here is expressing the fact that there's something else going on here. There's basically rolling something national, something massive, a massive punishment. This is what the text is basically saying, at mm-hmm. least in my opinion, that there's a punishment coming on here, falling on the people of Israel through an individual story, and God is basically sitting there going, you're going to cook in your own soup.
So you're saying there's a background story that we're not aware of that relates to the Israelites?
No, there's not a background story. There's a hint here that God is basically saying, you're going to cook in your own soup. I am not getting involved here. You have to punish yourself. You have to either sort it out or punish yourself. But there's an element here. You know, I will shun my face away from you. I turn my face away from you. Mm-hmm. He's communicating with him, but he's not helping. He's not. He's just sitting there going like, you know, you can. And it's like, first of all, this is, you know, from here, this is where God's first time really appears, and he speaks to them. But it's all very kind of like muffled and subtle. There's no clear indication of what's going to happen. You know, usually the eternal God says, should I go? Yes. Would I win? Yes. You know, the next time we see asking God, and it's usually understood to be asking the Urim and Thummim, the Urim and Thummim.
Sure.
It's understood to be that. And the next time, the other times we see this, specifically in the book of Samuel, we have, you know, arise and succeed, or yes, they'll do something. Very concise, very clear answers. Here, it's like as if to do whatever,
like
you want.
Like an indifference almost. And so they go out again, and then 18,000 more of the children of Israel were cut down to the ground. So where are we up to? 18, 22, that's 40,000 have fallen against Benjamin, and all the children of Israel.
A tenth, that is, by the way, a tenth.
That is You're absolutely right.
It's there, a tenth.
40,000, 400,000 came out, drew the sword, and 40,000 have fallen so far. And so the people went came.
And by the way, that's significant because they mentioned that they took a tenth for the provisions. It's not.
That's true.
the numbers here are not a coincidence. In this case, numbers are not coincidence. There's something going on here as well.
Yeah, there is. There must be. But I have difficulty putting this together. But they went to Bet El again, and they wept, and they sat there before Yehovah. They fasted that day until evening, and they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before Yehovah, so the children of Israel inquired of Yehovah. And the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days, and Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before it in those days, saying...
And there's a hint here. It's interesting. There's a hint here, because the Ark is in Bethel, and they're sacrificing there. There's a hint here that's... What exactly is going on with the temple here? It could be... First of all, we have now a clear indicator of the time. Pinchas ben Eleazar ben Aaron. Mm-hmm. This is several years after they entered the land. Pinchas, who was in the desert originally, is now the high priest. So there's a clear indication here of when this was happening, when this happened, and it means this was very early on. This was very, very early on, and look at the mess that they were in.
Yeah.
This is probably just a few years after Joshua died.
Now, clearly, there's an altar here. They're offering burnt offerings.
There's a temple. There's actually a temple. This might have been one of the places where the tabernacle sat for a while. Mm. I mean, we essentially see in places where the tabernacle was in a place called Gilgal. It was in a place called Shiloh, and it was in a place called Givon for a while as well. Mm-hmm. But I think here the text gives us a hint that it was in Bethel for a while as well. And there's probably a reason why it was in Bethel for a while. It might have been one of the first places it was. Because it mentions in Joshua that the tabernacle was in Shiloh. Mm-hmm. But now we see that the ark is in Bethel. Now, distance in between Bethel and Shiloh is not big, okay? But mm-hmm. Bethel is south of Shiloh, which means Bethel is close to the place that we identify as Givah. So they might have moved the tabernacle. They might have moved part of the tabernacle to a closer place, but still a place that's considered to be holy to them. Because Yaakov does say, that it will be a house of God. Mm-hmm.
True.
So they probably might have moved part of the tabernacle, at least the altar and the ark, maybe the entire tabernacle, mm-hmm. all to Bethel, which raises an interesting question about how permanent the tabernacle in Shiloh was, mm-hmm. and was it possible to have different places for the tabernacle to be. Even though we have kind of an indication in the book of Samuel that Shiloh, and we have in Jeremiah that Shiloh is first of all the first place that God put his name in, but it also gives us kind of a direction about, can the place of the house of God be a portable thing? Can we actually move it?
Mm.
So it seems that at least before Jerusalem was chosen, is that wherever the tabernacle goes, that's a place that God chose,
mm.
which is a reinterpretation of the verses in Deuteronomy, which says "Amakom asher yivchal," the place that God will choose, because it's yivchal as a future tense. But it gives an option here. At least, again, the issue of Jerusalem is another discussion by itself, and we'll get to it when we go to the Book of Kings. But at least at the time, wherever the tabernacle was, that was a place that God chose.
Mm.
So it could be that they saw no problem, and in their mind there was no issue of, we need a tabernacle somewhere else, we move it, and the presence of God moves with it.
Hmm. And that's certainly valid and plausible. That's fair enough. It's worth thinking about. So in any case, that's where they are. And this is what Pinchas says, and I assume it was him that was speaking before in the singular. He says, "Shall I yet again go out to battle against the children of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease?" And now he says, "Or shall I cease?" And now Yoel, Yehovah said, "Go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand." So now they have...
It's clear. Now they know what's going to happen.
Now they know what's going to happen. But the interesting thing about it, right, let me read on, because it says, then Israel set men in ambush. Okay, so they've got the strategy going on, and the children...
Exactly.
They went up, and Benjamin on the third day, they put themselves in battle array as other times, and Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city, and they began to strike down and kill some of the people as at other times. And we find out a little further on, it's about 30 people. 30 people of Israel get struck down, even though Yehovah said to Pinchas, "Go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand." It's not a guarantee that they won't lose any men.
Exactly.
That just, for me, let me just say this. For me, and from the tradition that I grew up in, Yoel, and I know that so many of the Truth to You listeners share similar traditions from where I came from, that really does make you or demand that you reconsider who you believe God is and the characteristics of God. When you read chapter 20, and it just makes you reconsider some things, I have to say.
I'm sorry I have to ask, but can you elaborate on that? Because I have no idea what you're talking
about. Well, okay, so let me tell you. In the tradition that I'm brought up in, there's an enormous emphasis that God is a God of love and flowers and rainbows and Tweety birds. And, you know, that if God says, you know, this is what's going to happen, well, then we're going to be victorious and we'll all be victorious because God loves us and he's a God of love. But it's an interesting thing, I find, that it almost seems like there's an indifference of God here. And I'm willing to be wrong about that, but he tells them to go up. He says, send Judah first. Oh, go up again against them again. This time go up and I'll deliver them into your hand. But even then, 30 of them die. And it's not the kind of picture that is painted in the Constantinian church, I can tell you.
So the pitch for selling Christianity in the ancient world was the issue. And now you explain, I know exactly what you're talking about. The pitch was the love, the fact that he loves you. He cares for you. You have to remember, in the ancient world, the gods were mean. They were nasty, you know, people. Because they were people also. They were considered to be people. They had characteristics of some of the, you know, if you read some of the stories about the gods, it's almost like a soap opera.
Sure.
I mean, and suddenly someone comes up to you and says, there's a God that loves you, that cares about you. So one of the things that they weren't telling you is that this God has a will. He has a thing called the Torah. You know, they had to get rid of the Torah to sell it because the Torah has a list of demands. And the Torah tells you, if you do something wrong, I will spank you.
Sure.
Quoting a movie I saw many years ago. You know? Sure. And God basically says, listen, I love you. As God says in Malachi, he says, you hate us. No, I love you. I hate Esau. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is the element of love, but there's also the element of righteousness, of justice. And God basically says, it says in I think it's either Habakkuk or Nahum, it says El Kana Venokem. You know, God has his jealousy, mm-hmm. and his vengeance that he brings upon his enemies. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember there's a balance here. So we in Judaism actually see God as the classic Prasad said at this time, also next week we'll say it, is Avinu Malkeinu, our father, our king. Mm-hmm. Basically realizing he loves us, but he's still a king. He's still a master of the universe. And this is why we send the blessings. You know, Melech HaOlam, king of the world, king of the universe. You know, you are our God. You are, king of the universe, but you still love us. Mm. And this is the element that always has to be reminded to people. You know, when I hear people say, you know, he loves you, Christians that had discussions with me say, oh, you know, he loves you. And I look at them and I say, you're talking as if I've never read the Bible.
Mm.
Now, they're specifically referencing to Jesus, but they're talking to me from the direction of God. Now, I don't exactly understand some of the mindset that people have had discussions with, but when they tell you, he loves you, and I look at them and I really, the first time I heard that, I was like, listen, and said, do you truthfully assume I've never understood that? You truthfully assume I've never actually read the Bible? No, the Bible is always full that God's angry with everyone and says, no, it does. No, it's not. You know, but you do have to remember that there's an element of justice that God works by.
And that's
even ones that he loves. He brings justice. He chastises the ones he loves because he loves them so much. And when he sees them doing something wrong, he punishes them. Mm-hmm. But one of the things about, and probably some people are going to there might be a revelation for some people, but one of the elements the church was trying to show is that God loves us. God is a God of love, and therefore he's punishing the Jews, he's punishing the Israelites because he no longer loves them, he's abandoned them. There's a lot of subtle politics and games in the terminology used in the church. If he loves you, nothing bad will happen to you. But if you're suffering, he hates you.
And there it is.
There's a game. Yeah. And you know, this is why, for example, I admire what you and Ira are doing with the book of Job, because the book of Job touches on one very simple thing. Why is there suffering in the world? So one of the things the church was trying to say is the reason you're suffering is because God hates you. You're not in grace. You've done something wrong.
You've stepped out of grace. This, that, and the other. That's right. And if everything's going right, if you're seemingly blessed, then that's because God loves you and you're doing something right. But here's the friction, because what I want to know, and I know that we can't answer this definitively, but perhaps you have an opinion. What do you think went through the minds of Israel? Let's say Pinchas. What do you think went through the mind of Pinchas when God says to him, "Go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand," and then 30 of them die? How would he have understood that? What would have gone through his mind, do you think?
I think we should go even backwards before that. What was going through Pinchas' mind? First, remember, Pinchas was the one with the zeal. Mm-hmm. Please remember that. Pinchas was the one who took the spear, went into the tent and went, flunge, kill them. Yep. And, the way it's described in the Midrash is even loonier. It's just like he walks, he had this long spear and he stabs them and he lifts them and walks out with them to show everyone what he did.
Whoa.
And so remember, Pinchas is the one with the zeal. Mm-hmm. But we have to, he's the high priest. Now, remember, Levites and priests were not really at war. They never really went out to war. Their job was something completely different. And we don't see the children of the Levites, because there's actually 13 tribes. Mm-hmm. But Levi is out of the picture. And he's standing there, and he probably, there could be several things. He might be the one in the zeal, and he's like, we have to do something about it. He could have been stood there and said, listen, this he might have, been very, very upset with what was going on, but, he was forced into it. They told him, you tell us, they might have threatened him as well. You never know. Sure.
Yeah, perhaps.
And what might have gone through Pinchas' mind is like, no, God, please, give this. He might have stood there when he was asking the last time. He says, God, please put an end to this.
Well, he says, or shall I cease? Should I stop this? No, is this a mistake?
That's the question that they're asking. And there's an element here where they're basically, you can see the distress, that they don't really want to do this, but they understand there's a need here to take care, because there's places where God says, if you ignore, specifically it mentions, if there's a man, person who's worshiping idols, if you ignore,
it talks about a city though, doesn't it? It goes on after that and talks about a city, now that I think of it. I'm just trying to remember where that is.
That's in Deuteronomy, and let me think for a second.
Because it says that...
Not very good in chapters.
Because you're right, it says, if you hear someone saying, let's go and serve other gods, then you shall be the first to do them in, basically. But then it goes on, if I remember correctly, it goes on to say, if a city says, is doing the wrong thing, we're going to have to find it. I can't...
This is chapter 13 in Deuteronomy.
Is it? Okay, I'll race you.
No, I'm already there.
Oh, you're there. Oh, okay. Chapter 13, I'm blicking over there now.
When it comes to the book of Deuteronomy, I actually had a study partner that we decided to memorize the book of Deuteronomy.
Oh, good grief. That's incredible.
So there was a time, for about a year or so, I was able to recite most of the book of Deuteronomy from memory.
If you hear someone, here it is. Okay, so verse 12. If you hear someone in your, of chapter 13, if you hear someone in one of your cities, which Jehovah your God gives you to dwell in, saying, corrupt men have gone out from among you and enticed the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which you have not known, then you shall inquire and search out and ask diligently, and if it is indeed true and certain that such an abomination was committed among you, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it, all that is in it, and its livestock with the edge of the sword, and you shall gather its plunder and so on and so forth. But Yoel, that's So that's, but that's if they say, let's serve other gods.
Idolatry. No. So this is what's strange here. They're not supposed to do this. Yeah. There's another place, again, it has to do the same, the verse I was quoting has to do also with idolatry. So it raises a question, what is going through their head? This is not what you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the reason I brought it up. They're not commanded to do that. They're supposed to do something like this only when there's idolatry. This was just you're waging a war here for no Torah reason.
Yeah, there's no precedent to go to war against them. And what you're saying is perhaps this is the reason why God is not guaranteeing their safety.
Exactly.
Okay, that I can deal with. I can deal with that.
And I can imagine Pinchas standing there and basically like going, when is this thing gonna? He might have been standing there distressed. You know, let's stop this thing. And what's interesting, you don't hear his voice here as the high priest. He doesn't tell them, you know, listen, the Torah does not command us to wage war on an entire tribe.
Perhaps that's what he should have done.
And this is maybe why he's mentioned here. Not only as a timeline, there's criticism here. You as the high priest should know this.
Yeah.
Why you're allowing them to go out to war?
Very good point.
And it might have been that he was cornered. He might have been cornered to be enforced to do this.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. In any case, so 30 of them died, and the children of Benjamin said, we're killing them again and defeating them as we did before. But the children of Israel said, quick, let's flee and draw them away from the city to the highways. So all the men of Israel rose from their place and put themselves in the battle array at Baal Tamar, and Israel's men in ambush burst forth from their positions on the plain of Geba. And 10,000 select men from all Israel came against Giva, and the battle was fierce. Now, we don't often hear that, do we? I mean, where else does it say, and the battle was fierce? We don't usually get any kind of details, like a couple of verses and the thing happened. But here we have
There's a few places I think we have this term, but essentially it's a relatively rare term. So this was massive battle. And think about it, this is huge army. Battling this tiny little army, and we take the comparison, and it's a fearsome war. Mm. It makes you wonder. It's interesting. So it kind of tells you something about the Benjamites as well, but it can also give you an indication about, you know, it could be that God was helping the Benjamites as well to punish the people of Israel.
Perhaps because they've entered into some sort of judgment that doesn't have a Torah precedent, and so therefore. Perhaps you're right. Perhaps God is not guaranteeing the safety of anyone here. They're going to learn a lesson. They're going to learn it hard. And so it says, the Benjamites did not know that the disaster was upon them. And now here it is in verse 35, Jehovah defeated Benjamin before Israel. And the children of Israel destroyed that day 25,100 Benjamites, all those that drew the sword. Now, if we do the math, as we were talking about before, it says there were 26,000 of them, therefore there's 900 left, one would assume. But it says, so that the children of Benjamin saw that they were defeated. The men of Israel had given ground to the Benjamites because they had relied on the men in ambush, whom they had set quickly, who they had set against Giba. And the men in ambush quickly rushed upon Giba. The men in ambush spread out and struck the whole city with the edge of the sword. Now, we're to understand here that they destroyed everyone, right? The whole city. I mean, that's the women, the children, the old, the young. Everyone's gone, right?
More or less. They're basically passing a judgment like the same way they would have done to the seven nations who were living in the land, or it was idolatry.
Yeah.
And it's not it. This was a case of rape. This is, you know, we just catch the person that they did rape and murder and just execute them. You know, there's a certain level...
Not to diminish what happened to the concubine, but we're talking about one woman, and this is the situation that it eventuated into. And now it says, the appointed signal between the men of Israel and the men in ambush was that they would make a great cloud of smoke that rise up from the city, whereupon the men of Israel would turn in battle. And now Benjamin had begun to strike.
There's a lot of description here of the tactic. It's very interesting that it details the tactic so much.
And it is interesting because it tells you first in the previous verses what actually happened, but then it reiterates what happened and goes into the detail.
Mm-hmm.
Because it already says, now Benjamin had begun to strike and kill about 30 of the men of Israel, and they said, surely we have defeated them as before. And it almost makes me think,
it's,
well,
it's, it's going back, and it's interesting. It's going back.
It's repeating itself.
It's repeating itself, and some people say it's a level. There's a level of confusion here in the text. Why is it mentioned this again?
Well, because what you said before makes sense. Like perhaps there was a collation of information, a collection of writings, and here's possibly two accounts of the same events from different sources or from different families, perhaps. And they decided, look, let's just put them together. They both go here. Mm-hmm. Let's join them here, and we'll put them at the end.
Exactly.
I think that's probably more likely. And so this is the same account in a slightly different way. In verse 40, when the cloud began to rise from the city and the column of smoke, the Benjamites looked behind them, and there was a whole city going up in smoke to heaven, it says. And when the men of Israel turned back, the men of Benjamin panicked, for they saw the disaster had come upon them. Therefore, they turned their backs before the men of Israel in the direction of the wilderness, but the battle overtook them, and whoever came out of the cities they destroyed in their midst, they surrounded the Benjamites, chased them, and easily tramped them down as far as...
And the language is also the ויפנו לפני איש ישראל לדרך המדבר ומלחמה התבקעת הוא, ואשר מהערים משחיתים אותו בתוכו, ואשר מהערים משחיתים אותו בתוכו, is incorrect grammar.
It's a bit disjointed, isn't it?
Yeah. There's a lot of disjunctive.
Because it's clumsy in the English as well.
The Hebrew is very clumsy. The form "Va'asher meharim mashchitim oto betocho." It's completely disjunctive. There's no logic. "Va'asher meharim" could be one sentence, but this is it's called Hebrew mishpat zikan. It happens to me sometimes. I forget the names I'm looking for.
But the way
it's
the
a causative.
Way...
Sorry, it's a causative sentence. Va'asher meharim, those which are in the city, and it says mashchitim otom. There is a certain level. I mean, I can understand what's going on here. Why is he using oto instead of otam? Vayifno is a plural, and then hidbakatu, first of all, being very very strange. It's almost poetic. Hidbakatu is single. And Va'asher meharim is single, mashchitim oto, but we're not talking about a single, we're talking about several cities, and the oto refers to the people, but we haven't mentioned the people which are in the city. It does mention people from the city, but not exactly, and it's just the whole section is like, what is going on here?
It seems a little disjointed, a little bit clumsy, but it also seems to add to the panic of the situation.
Exactly.
Now, I don't know if that's intentional, but it kind of does have that effect.
I've seen someone who says that someone claims it's written like this deliberately to express the issue of the panic, the sheer confusion of what's going on. Okay. So that there actually is an opinion like that as well. I can't remember exactly who it was, but I remember seeing something like that.
Some possibilities. And so 18,000 men of Benjamin fell. All these were men of valor. And then they turned and they fled toward the wilderness, the rock of Rimmon. And they were cut down, 5,000 of them. So now we're up on the highways. That's 23,000. Then they pursued them relentlessly to Gidom and 2,000. So there's 25,000. So all who fell in Benjamin that day were 25,000 men who drew the sword, and all these were men of valor. But 600, verse 47, but 600 men turned and fled towards the wilderness. So what we have now is 25,000, but over in verse 35, it says 25,100, which should leave us 900, but it leaves us 600. So there's the discrepancy, people. I won't go over it again. I'll let you do the math if you're interested. But there's the discrepancy in the math. 600 men turned and fled. And the men of Israel turned back against the children of Benjamin and struck them down with the edge of the sword from every city, man and beast, who were found. They also set fire to all the cities they came to. And so they really did a thorough job of the situation.
They're doing the exact same thing. The law of Torah talks about idolatry. So I think I was confusing idolatry with adultery, maybe. In English it works, in Hebrew it doesn't. You know, you can confuse idolatry with adultery. You know, they sound very similar. In Hebrew, they're completely different words. But if they were speaking English, I can understand the confusion. But there's an issue here with the numbers. And when you sum it up, there's a few hundred people missing, which raises expressions. I mean, it could have been, you know, it's like the issue, for example, when was the first temple destroyed? The 7th of the 5th month or 10th of the 5th month? There's a bit of an issue there as well. Mm-hmm. And between, I think it's the two prophets, I can't remember, maybe it was Rashi or something. Rashi says, probably based on the Talmud, saying there was confusion and people didn't remember what the date was. So they wrote both of them because there was the level of confusion. Here as well, there could be a massive confusion, but the numbers as well, because it was a war. And we said, as you said, something very, very important, that this confusion kind of helps express the panic, the sheer panic that was going on here. And there's also a few interesting things here as well. You know, there's kind of like poetic language here as well. So some people say, you know, it says here, Kiteru et Binyamin hirdefuhu menuchai drichuhu anocha chagivam mimizrach shamesh. You know, it almost sounds like part of a song, so it could be some of the information was from some song that was sung about this was what happened. Actually is in the ancient world, and it still exists in tribal nations. For example, in North India, there's a group called the Men Menasse. They claim to be descendants of this tribe of Menashe, and they pass their stories down through song. And so it's understood to be that singing was, the songs were part of how history was passed down. So we can see echoes of a song here as well. So it could be someone had something written and also a few songs which were sung and contradicting information. And they tried to compile this all up and said, okay, this is the piece of information we have from here. And this is the piece of information we have from over there. And this is why there's a few hundred people get lost somewhere. 26,000, 25,700, 25,900. It seems it's coming from different sources.
I'm strongly inclined as well. Yeah, I think so. I think it's probably two different accounts of the same situation, and they've just
only two.
Well, maybe there's more. Maybe there is more. I don't know, but certainly from verse 36 and on, even maybe from verse 38 and on, but it could be a difference. Recording of the same events that has been put together, and therefore the math doesn't quite join. So there's something to ponder anyway. There's something for the listeners to ponder. If they have any information on that or an opinion, we would love to hear from them. But in any case, what happens is they've pretty much almost but wiped out Benjamin, and this sets the scene for chapter 21, which we're going to do next week. And Yoel, it is the last chapter of Judges. What are we going to do?
I think we finish Judges and that's that. I think we'll finish with Leah the Prophet.
No, what are you talking about? We got to do it. What's the next book? What are we going to do after that?
So the next book is the Book of Samuel, The Light at the End of the Tunnel. Nice. A lot of information in the Book of Samuel. These historical books. I mean, if we sat down like every historical piece of information we can pull out from this. You know, background stuff that we can do recordings of hours, which we won't.
You're right when you say we need a light at the end of the tunnel because chapter 21 doesn't offer it. That's for sure.
So this is where Light of the Prophets really starts becoming a light.
Good.
Okay. We call it Light of the Prophets. That was a name I came up with several months ago.
And it's a good one. But these last verses, you go, this is the mess of the prophets. This is 19 and 20 and exactly. 21. It just doesn't help. But there's certainly things to be learned there, nevertheless, and we will go through them because they are important. So that is it, my friends. Thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo. Just a reminder to everybody, Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page. Hebrew in Israel, like the page, get involved there. And if you would like Hebrew lessons from the Levite in the land, you can inquire by emailing at hebrewinisrael@gmail.com and get on the waiting list, right?
Regarding lessons, yes. So first of all, I'm more or less fully booked. What I have in plan is also starting a study group. Now, this won't be there's already quite a few people who have signed up, so the first group is more or less full. But I want to see how exactly I do this. I know a lot of people don't really have time during the week. It's only on Sundays, but unfortunately, some my Sundays are completely packed. That's when everyone has free time. So my Sundays, there's no room for anything.
How do people contact you in regards to this?
So the same thing, the same way. You can either send me an email. If you already have a group, you have a study group that you anyhow belong to, then you can just add this to part of what you want to actually teach. Mm-hmm. The lessons will be heavily based on the Hebrew text. There will be a certain level of learning Hebrew itself. There will be a lot of grammar insight in things. This is an idea someone suggested to me a couple of days ago. I didn't think about it up to now. It's not a Hebrew lesson. It's just studying the Bible through the Hebrew.
So it's not a formal Hebrew lesson. It's the Suzuki method of Hebrew, right? For those who are exactly familiar with their violin.
Yeah, so kind of like the Suzuki method. There's a certain level. So the basic plan is first of all, to be a low cost lesson. Mm-hmm. You know, looking at $30-$40 per lesson. We're looking at, because it's a group, so it's low. And by the way, you know, for example, there are systems that I teach, but I'm basically trying to break the market here, so it's going to be relatively not trying to, you know, hurt anyone's income or anything. But the type of lesson I want to do is basically we take a section. It might be based on the parasha.
Mm-hmm.
Every week we learn a section. It's not going to be a very long lesson either, because basically it's going to be like an hour and a bit. The whole idea is to give people access to the Hebrew so they can hear the Hebrew, they can learn some of the Hebrew, they can learn things that you don't see immediately when you read the English text. There will be grammar, I mean, places where I'll mention grammatical rules, mm-hmm. and ideas. There's the ability to interact. That's one of the things. The idea is to create a relatively small group, 6, 7, maybe 10 people. But when I say 10 people, it can be your entire family. There can be 50 people sitting around one computer, but you pay for one, like, as if you're one person.
Sure.
That's the other thing that I'm playing here with. So, I mean, it will be courtesyful if there's two families sitting next to one computer, they each family will pay. And that's stuff that, you know, we'll get to it. But I'm going to do a very low cost. There's interaction. You can ask questions in the middle. I'm trying to find a way, a mechanism. If anyone has any idea there out there, what kind of webbing type of system I can use, so I can share the screen, I can move things around, so people can do this. Because, for example, if you do Skype, then it's iffy and it doesn't really give you a lot of options and stuff like that. But, you know, for example, pulling up a Hebrew text and going over the words, building vocabulary.
So what kind of platform? Sure. So if there are. Yeah. That's a great idea. So if there are listeners who have expertise or some experience with another platform that might suit to do something like that, an opportunity where multiple people can get together and have a lesson with Yoel, where they can get up close and personal with the Hebrew text with Yoel, I think that's a marvelous idea, Yoel. They'd want to be quick. So
one thing I'm saying, this is not going to be, you know, academic level. This is not going to be something you'll sit there and you'll be scratching your head. That's not the point. Because mm-hmm. there can be people in the group. We can have a mixed group where some people can read Hebrew, some people don't. There's not going to be any requirement of learning Hebrew, but it enables you to come close to the Hebrew and see the Hebrew and hear the Hebrew. Because we're going to start off with me actually reading the text and reading the text slowly and explaining the words and relating the words to other things. And you know, in time, each group will start off with only me reading, and slowly each group people would develop inside a group, and we're talking about a long-term thing. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if you can't show up or you don't have the money or whatever it is, if you miss a few lessons, you haven't lost anything. You can drop out, and worst comes to worst, you join a different group, another group that begins from the beginning, or mm-hmm. we put you in. And it's dynamic. There's a lot of games that can be played with this, and you're not really even committed. Because you can drop out whenever you want.
So they're not obligated. There's no
commitment here. You decide that, you know, this is too intense or it's not enough. And so it's dynamic. Because, you know, for example, if, you know, if half the group drops out, I can just join the other half to another half and continue. It's something that could be continuous, and you can join in at any stage as well, as provided this. So at the moment, there's one group developing, and there's even one person I'm actually very happy decided. Rick Winkler, who's going to also...
G'day, Rick.
Hopefully, yeah, he's going to join. He was one of the first people to say yes. And so I'm very happy because it's, you know, actually people who follow me on the Facebook thing, which are, you know, excited to hear about this idea. So, you know, hi, Rick. You know, and hopefully we'll be able to... Yeah. And so the whole idea is to start this off... start yourself after the feast. I just have to get the internet system here working. But if there's anyone out there who can help out with a platform, because I'm not that, don't really understand much about computers. So that person will
be worth a while. And so this is an opportunity. And so again, listeners, if this interests you as it pans out over the next few weeks, want to be quick. And again, the email is hebrewinisrael@gmail.com, hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. to express your interest in something like that. And if you have any ideas as to how it may work, please, by all means, contact Yoel on that email address. And also, we know that there is, in the next few weeks, we should be seeing, I believe, a Hebrew in Israel website. Is that correct?
We're working on that. I have to give thanks to one of my students. You know who you are. I don't know if they're willing to mention their name, so you know who you are. You're doing a wonderful job,
and we love you too.
Remember that we all love you, and you should know that you're helping spread something which at least some of us understand is important. And you get brownie points.
you get brownie points, and so we'll keep listeners up to date as that eventuates as well. You've been listening to Truth to You on truth2letteru.org, and if these programs have been a blessing to you, you can also show your support by donating at truth2you.org. And next week, the final chapter of Judges, chapter 21. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom.